This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Progressives in the West are strong advocates of women's rights and also of multiculturalism. Well, they're put in a bind whenever these two causes are at odds, and they really are when it comes to the way that women tend to be treated in Muslim societies. There were two Muslim women who recently testified before a Senate committee about this very subject, and the women senators on the panel completely ignored them. We're going to talk about why there is this stunning double standard on the issue of women's rights. As of this past Saturday, Canada is 150 years old. This nation was founded as a dominion of the British monarchy, but a recent poll shows that a majority of Canadians want to cut ties with the royal family. Why is that? We're going to talk about this with trumpet writer and native Canadian Abraham Blondeau. Is vegetarianism healthy? A lot of people would tell you yes, stay away from meat. Well, we're going to talk with nutritionist Jörg Mardian to get his thoughts on the subject. He always brings balance and perspective to these kinds of issues. You're going to find that this is no exception. And I'll finish off the program today by talking about how the brightest days for America and Britain lie yet ahead. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. In America and in many Western nations, there are advocates for women's rights who speak out forcefully on issues like unequal pay and abortion access. Meanwhile, they ignore and excuse what really are important women's rights. They ignore horrific treatment of girls and women in Muslim societies. It's really a bizarre paradox. Just what a difference there is between the way they speak out on certain issues and totally ignore other issues. It's a classic example of modern moral absurdity. People fixate on non-issues in the name of justice, quote unquote. They tolerate or even perpetrate shocking injustices. There was an incident just a few weeks ago that exposed the perverseness of this inconsistency. It was June 14th. There were two Muslim women testifying before a U.S. Senate committee hearing on ideology and terror, understanding the tools, tactics, and techniques of violent extremism. One of the women who spoke, she's quite an extraordinary woman, Ayan Hirsi Ali. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She was a representative in the Dutch Parliament some years ago, but she's written books, and she's quite an amazing, outspoken advocate of women's rights, and she speaks out against Islamic oppression of women. The other woman, another amazing author, journalist, she was an instructor at Georgetown University. Her name is Azra Nomani. Now, they're both very strong critics of the way that Islam treats women. And because they are, they routinely receive death threats from Muslims. Back in 2004, Ayan Ali, she collaborated on a film called Submission that she put together with Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh. And you might remember, I mean, that film showed just how cruel Islam can be. Theo van Gogh was actually murdered for making that film by a Muslim extremist. This is the kind of opposition that Ayan and Azra are accustomed to being up against. They know that when they speak out against Islam, that it makes them a target. But they are Muslims. They're just against the way that many Muslims treat women. But at any rate, they were testifying before this Senate committee, and it was a hearing that took place in Washington, D.C., and it was on the very day, June 14th, just hours after Representative Steve Scalise was shot over in Virginia at a Republican baseball practice. Well, just before the hearing started, there was a man in the room. He was wearing a Muslim prayer cap. He stood up and he was heckling these two women, and the security, congressional police were on high alert, and the representative who was chairing the meeting, you can see it in the video if you go to the website that has the video of the hearing. He's actually calling everyone to order right as the video begins because of this this disruption from this Muslim. So this is the kind of, this gives you an idea of the climate in which these two women, these courageous Muslim women, were asked to speak out on the subject of Islamic extremism and their treatment of women. On the Senate panel that was listening to them, there were four female Democrat senators: California's Kamala Harris, North Dakota's Heidi Heitkamp, New Hampshire's Maggie Hassan, and Missouri's Claire McCaskill. Now, all four of these women, this is like the classic women's rights, Western women's rights advocates. But they are not interested in the women's rights that these Muslim women are advocating. None of those senators, those women senators, asked a single question of Ayan and Asra. And according to Asra, they wouldn't even look these two women in the eye. She was trying to make eye contact with them, and they were not even willing to look at her. They were not concerned about women being unfairly discriminated against among Islamic society. They were actually, the concern that they expressed was about, well, this hearing, it seems like it's focusing unnecessarily on religion, that we were actually discriminating against Islam in holding that kind of a hearing. Well, shortly after the hearing, Ayan and Asra actually wrote an article in the New York Times, and it is an amazing article, and I just like to read some of the excerpts of this to you. They talked about the treatment that they received at the hands of this congressional committee. So this article by these two women, they said, "Just as we are invisible to the mullahs at the mosque, we were invisible to the Democratic women in the Senate." Now just think about what they're saying here. They wrote, "What happened that day was emblematic of a deeply troubling trend among progressives. When it comes to the pay gap, abortion access, and workplace discrimination, progressives have much to say. But we're still waiting for a march against honor killings, child marriages, polygamy, sex slavery, or female genital mutilation." I mean, this is the disparity between the kind of issues that feminists in the West are actually willing to go on the march for and speak out against versus the ones that they want to pretend don't exist. They're not interested in going after what's happening in Muslim cultures. These two women, after in this article, after they described the personal suffering that they had experienced at the hands of their own Muslim community, they wrote this: "In other words, when we speak out about Islamist oppression, we bring personal experience to the table in addition to our scholarly expertise. Yet the feminist mantra, so popular when it comes to victims of sexual assault, 'believe women first,' isn't extended to us. Neither is the notion that the personal is political, or our political conclusions are dismissed as personal, and our personal experiences dismissed as political." These two women went on saying, "That's because in the rubric of identity politics, our status as women of color is canceled out by our ideas, which are labeled conservative, as if opposition to violent jihad, sex slavery, genital mutilation, or child marriage were a matter of left or right. This not only silences us, it also puts beyond the pale of liberalism a basic concern for human rights and the individual rights of women abused in the name of Islam." And they're really drawing attention to a phenomenal hypocrisy on the part of these Western feminists. What is the real concern here? Are they actually concerned about looking after the welfare of women and going after those who are mistreating them? You can see the moral inversion is phenomenal, and it really shows just how politically motivated they are. They're not actually interested first and foremost in women's rights. They're interested in a particular trying to get across a particular political view within the West, and they're overlooking just abominable tyranny taking place elsewhere. These two women go on in this New York Times op-ed. There is a real discomfort among progressives on the left with calling out Islamic extremism. Partly they fear offending members of a, quote, minority religion and being labeled racist, bigoted, or Islamophobic. There is also the idea, which has tremendous strength on the left, that non-Western women don't need saving, quote unquote, and that the suggestion that they do is patronizing at best. After all, the thinking goes, if women in America still earn less than men for equivalent work, who are we to criticize other cultures? That really is a remarkable, incisive commentary, that paragraph. I mean, they talk about quite a number of points that are really worth digesting. But this idea that essentially a Muslim society, because they are a minority religion, which is laughable in and of itself. I mean, it's an absolutely huge religion, but that we have no moral standing to criticize them, because to do so would be Islamophobic or racist or bigoted. It shows just the kind of dead ends that you end up in if you treat other cultures as being beyond reproach, that we are not allowed to criticize when they're doing things that are clearly wrong, that we have to be able to have moral absolutes that enable us to speak out when things are wrong. But we have abdicated that ability because we don't believe in absolutes. Everything is relative to the point that you can't even label a genocidal dictator as what he is, because we can't say that that's absolutely wrong. Maybe it's right in his worldview, something like that. But they're specifically talking about the fact that if you look at the way that we treat women and you look at something like the pay gap, which is provably false, which is it does not exist the way that they are contending that it does, that men and women receive different pay for equal work. That is not true, and it has been proven over and over and over again. It is absolutely provable that employers do not prejudice, they do not have prejudice against paying women what they are worth, because if they did, then if you could really get more work out of a woman for less pay, then every employer would go out there and just hire more women, because that would it would put them at an economic advantage to do that. But the fact that we supposedly have this sin makes it so that we are in no moral standing to be able to condemn others for their sins against women, as if something like a wage gap is morally equivalent to something like sex slavery. But they continue in this article, this is extreme moral relativism disguised as cultural sensitivity, and it leads good people to make excuses for the inexcusable. You really ought to go to the New York Times, and I don't say that all that often, but this op-ed by these two women is really exceptional. I think they make some excellent points in it, but this is the kind of hypocritical idiocy that smart people end up embracing when they abandon moral absolutes. When you embrace relativism, then it leads you to increasingly indefensible double standards until, like they're describing here, even minor or imagined offenses by the privileged, quote unquote, outweigh egregious abuses and crimes that are committed by the victims. And that's the way that they would view these Muslims who are committing these crimes against women. really, the way that they describe this in this op-ed piece, it reminds me of a point that Melanie Phillips makes in her memoir, Guardian Angel. She talks about how the left often proves through their actions that what they're interested in more than anything is the appearance of seeking justice. That's more important than actually achieving justice. She wrote this: what matters to them above all is that they are seen to be virtuous and intelligent. They care about being seen to be compassionate. The banner behind which they march is not altruism. It is narcissism. If you just look at the women who are out there, the social justice warriors who are decrying injustices like the fact that the government isn't providing free abortions and they're not providing contraception on demand, if you can push them aside and look at the women that these two Muslims, these Muslim women who were testifying before this Senate committee, were defending, the poor girls who are having their genitals mutilated in the name of a religion, girls who are being forced to marry old men, girls who are getting sold into sex slavery. If you can think about the women that they're defending, women who are being murdered because they're receiving Islamic justice, quote unquote, for the crime of dishonoring their families by being raped or dishonoring their families by renouncing their religion. Think about those women. Think about the women that really do need justice. And know that God promises to avenge those injustices. You can read many biblical passages that talk about where he promises to look after those who have received injustice in this world today. There's one example, Zechariah 7, verses 8 through 14. You can read there where God commands that we show mercy and compassion to all people, that we not oppress the needy and the weak. And those commands are all over the Bible. But in this passage in Zechariah 7, he says that if you reject that command, if you are not compassionate, if you don't have mercy, if you do oppress the needy and the weak, that you're going to suffer, it says, a great wrath from the Lord of hosts. And he actually promises there that those who refused to hear the cries of the people they victimized, that God is going to close his ears to their cries when they're being punished and when they're receiving retribution for what they did. But you can see, even then, in the Bible as a whole, you see that God is only going to do that in order to teach them. In the end, even those who oppress, those who victimize, they are going to learn what real compassion is.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This past July 1st, this past Saturday, Canada turned 150 years old. It was 1867 that the British Parliament passed the British North America Act, and this made the Dominion of Canada, Dominion under the authority of the British monarchy. Well, a new poll says a majority of Canadians feel it's time for Canada to cut ties with the British monarchy. Well, it's an interesting argument that they're making, and there's a lot here that we can talk about with trumpet writer and native Canadian Abraham Blondeau. How are you, Abraham?
Good, doing very well.
So, happy Canada Day, belated Canada Day. So why has the monarchy been so important to Canada, just looked at from a historical standpoint?
Sure. So North America, for a long time, it was kind of in the flux of what European power would grab hold of it between Spain, France, and Britain. And during the Seven Years' War, Canada became British-dominated on the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. In Quebec, James Wolfe had a pretty stunning victory there, and that pretty much made Canada British. And so ever since the 1750s, Canada has been more or less under British control. And that includes America, the 13 colonies as well, up until July 4th, 1776. So the British monarchy has been very important because Canada is such a young nation. And it was a wild wilderness that had to be conquered, much like the American West and the American colonies, very similar experience. And so the colonists who came over from England and other places, the British monarchy was their tie to Europe, was their tie to a heritage they could look to and try to emulate. And so in Canada, except for the French-speaking population, which looked to France, of course, for most of Canada, the British monarchy has been kind of the guiding hand in our development as a nation. And so, for example, during the late 1800s, Canada started to move westward, much like the United States. And to avoid all the lawlessness that happened in America, all the gunfights and murders and things that happened in certain parts of the United States, Queen Victoria saw that, and she made the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, first called the Northwest Mounted Police, to try to create law and order in the West so that the gold rush in the Yukon, the creation of the railroad spanning coast to coast, could be completed without the prospect of people being robbed, of the Indian tribes getting into trouble, that sort of thing. And so the British monarchy brings a lot of wisdom and a lot of different experiences that the Canadians don't have by themselves, because our country is only 150 years old this year. So basically, that one example, but also throughout going into the World Wars, Canada was linked to the rest of the British Empire. And so Canada by itself, very small population, a lot of resources. And so by being tied to the British Empire, Canadian resources, Canadian ingenuity, different inventions Canadians made were able to have a much more global scope and impact because mm-hmm. it was tied to the British Empire through the British monarchy. And so culturally and even just economically, Canada has benefited a lot from being a part of a heritage where we can look to historical examples and realize other people tied to the British throne have conquered hardship and made new lands to look like something like Europe or affluent and prosperous. And so the British monarchy has really been the anchor of our culture and of our development, allowing us to have a place in the world, to have a voice, and not being swayed by this voices who want to go off the beaten track, so to say.
So just listening to you speak, it sounds like the arguments that you're making and the history, the way that you're giving it, that this is probably representative of the way that Canadians generally, with the exceptions, as you mentioned, of Quebecers, that this is the way that Canadians generally looked at the monarchy, the British monarchy, that there was a certain amount of pride, there was a certain amount of just a sense of community within the Commonwealth that they held. But that now this represents a minority view among Canadians, and something has shifted, and the Canadian attitude toward the monarchy is now taking a turn for the worse. Maybe you could just talk about what's happening now and why is it changing?
Sure. So I think the high point of Canadian patriotism to the British throne was in the World Wars. And at that point, there were still a lot of relatives living in Britain or other Commonwealth areas. So there was a literal tie of people living here to the home country. After that point, you have less of those family ties, but also you have the liberal and socialist movements begin in Canada. And so,
and why the change in the family ties? Is it just more immigration from elsewhere in the world into Canada?
Yes, yeah, that a lot after the World Wars, a lot of non-English speaking peoples migrated to Canada, especially from the Asian countries, the Far East, but also just the age. A lot of the older relatives died off because that's mm-hmm. And so the uncles, the aunts, the grandparents who stayed in England died usually in that generation, World War One to World War Two. And so all of the children in Canada didn't have any physical family in England to visit anymore, or any direct family.
Sure.
So that was a small part of it. I think the biggest part was in Canada. Canada is, I think, a few years ahead of America in terms of progression, social progression. And so,
like the progressivism as an ideology.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So in the West where I'm from, that was the birthplace of socialism in Canada, with a labor unions for farmers. And so socialism became a very powerful force in Canada, because most Canadians in the West were farmers, cattle ranchers, things that they needed a union to protect them. And then in the East, the two big powerful blocks are Ontario and Quebec, the French-speaking and English-speaking. And the big turning point came in the 1960s when Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau, was prime minister. And he completely revolutionized Canadian governance. And for a long time, Canada basically followed in the path of Great Britain, foreign policy, everything like that. Trudeau took a big turn off course. He reformed the Canadian Army, getting rid of a lot of the symbolism that tied us back to our British ancestry. But also he made the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which to many people is the centerpiece, or like the model of a liberal type government. But within it, it's bicultural. So it makes French and English equal cultures within Canada. So it dilutes the British monarchy, because now it's equal with the French heritage, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it does give the French Canadians more political power than their numbers would otherwise give them. But also within that, charters and rights and freedoms, it does away with the old way of thinking, and it brings in the new way of thinking towards equal rights for everyone, which has a lot of good reform in it, but it also opens the door for a lot of radical social change. And the good thing about the British monarchy is that it has been kind of a break on social change, which allows us to kind of second guess these changes and try to find the best course forward. Basically, what Pierre Trudeau's government did is it got rid of that break and it went straight forward. It got rid of the Red Ensign, which was a Canadian flag, which had a Union Jack on it. And instead, we have the maple leaf in the white field with the red size on it, which isn't necessarily a great representation of anything Canada is besides the maple leaf. But it did dilute a lot of symbols that were much more heavily British. And so it's really the Pierre Trudeau, that liberal government and that liberal movement, to open the door for radical social change. And that's really what this this poll that they just did is all about, I think, is that Canada is much more radical. The United States are much further down the line in terms of allowing social change. And so the British monarchy is really the last thing there, reminding Canadians of what they used to be, or of a different lifestyle than what they're espousing. And so I think Canada wants, a lot of the liberals in Canada want Canada to be a multicultural social warrior type society that can lead the world as an example. But in the background, you have the British monarchy, which represents a completely different way of living, a completely different set of morals and ethics. And so as long as those two are there, they can't really coexist. So one has to go, or the other won't work.
Is there any sense of, say, it's 53% of Canadians think that when Elizabeth II dies, that should be the end of Canada's ties with Britain today? Is there any sense, a breakdown in terms of demographics, that it's predominantly young people versus old people, or older Canadians? Or where the support for cutting ties is coming from?
This specific poll doesn't give that much of a breakdown on the ages, but based off of other polls over time and my time living up there, the young people are much more for Canada becoming a republic and doing away with the throne, and especially with the high amount of immigration in Canada. There are huge amounts of people coming from other countries that aren't English speaking. And so they have no, they would have no history with the British throne or any need to see it there.
What's interesting is just listening to you talk about what the throne represents to Canada and the fact that this has been sort of the bulwark against social change happening at too rapid of a pace. In a sense, you look at what's happening in Britain today, and the royal family is representing less and less of that kind of a bulwark, even within Britain, that we see in a lot of ways the British royal family going along with that same kind of move toward progressivism, and particularly in this year, in the last election, the way that the Jeremy Corbyn Labour Party did within Britain, and it seems that there's just a lot of movement in that direction. The royal party seems, the royal family, they seem much more in favor of social change, you know, accepting same-sex marriage, LGBT rights, and those types of things. So even the monarchy itself doesn't, you know, you're describing what it has represented to Canada, say, from a historical standpoint, but in a way, if that is what it represented, it's making itself irrelevant in a sense.
Right, exactly. And that's the part of this attitude or this trend in Canada is a reflection of the monarchy's decisions that they've made themselves, that they are no longer relevant in Canada if they don't, if they do change, because if they're the same as everyone else, then what's the point of having them there? Because mm-hmm. then we can have the same leadership from a completely Canadian institution. And so in Canada, with the constitutional setup, although the king and queen in Britain are over there, it's the lieutenant governor in Canada that really does, or sorry, excuse me, the governor general in Canada that really represents the queen and is seen as a separate check and balance on the Canadian parliament. So in Canada's constitutional setup, they have more of an influence than they even have in Britain, maybe. Just because of that individual person who has that office. But like you said, that the what they represent the Canadians is quickly evaporating because of the decisions they've made themselves to accept the social revolution instead of holding fast to the traditions that they normally represent. And so it is something that really started in the 1960s and but it really is full-fledged now, especially with Justin Trudeau as prime minister. Mm-hmm. He's really basically picking up where his father left off and driving headlong towards basically making Canada a republic, because Canada constitutionally could have the British throne there. But if you look at what the government stands for and what the government policies are, there really isn't a whole lot of influence left there. Mm-hmm. on for this heritage that the throne represents.
It's very interesting to see this happening really at the same time. I believe there's a similar movement that's gaining momentum in Australia, and just the hits that the British monarchy has been taking within Britain just over the last 6 months. Stephen Fleury's been talking quite a bit about it on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and just how we're seeing this acceleration of a movement that really is trashing what the monarchy has represented historically. Here, this is taking place right north of our border in Canada. We've been talking with trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about Canada and its relationship to the British throne, the fact that there is an increasing movement to cut ties between Canada and Britain. Abraham has written an article. You can read it online at thetrumpet.com. It's called Do Canadians Want to Get Rid of the British Monarchy? Thanks for your time, Abraham.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Is there something wrong with eating meat? Some people say that the key to healthy eating, both for ourselves and for our planet, is vegetarianism. They say it can help you lose weight, avoid disease, extend your life, and that it's better for the long-term health of the planet as well. But is vegetarian diet, as healthy as some experts make it out to be. Nutritionist Jorg Mardian says the answer might not be what you think. We have him via Skype from his office in British Columbia to talk about this. Hello, Jorg.
Hi there.
So where does this come from? How far back does vegetarianism go? This isn't a modern phenomenon necessarily.
Oh, absolutely not. It goes back thousands of years, but it's strongly linked to a number of religions, which originate in ancient India, actually. It centers on a principle of nonviolence applied to animals, and it has its origin in a lot of pagan practices. So you'll find it in Hinduism and Buddhism and such religions. But when you go to North America, it wasn't until the 1800s that the word vegetarian was actually coined. And so it's simply, vegetarianism is simply someone who avoids meat, but that's no longer the case because we have several types of vegetarianism now, as people just try to avoid eating too much processed meat. But the origins, you can go back and, it is confusing when you try to pin the exact origins of this, but it certainly goes back thousands of years. But here, it's still considered a fledgling movement, even in America, and it's not very, it's not that popular at all.
Well, you mentioned, just concern over meat processing, and there definitely are some things about the way that meat is produced in our day that is concerning. What sorts of scientific evidence are people looking at to say we need to trim down, cut back, or even eliminate intake of meat in our diet today?
Well, if you listen to the media today, it's everywhere. I mean, every study, every doctor will tell you, every association will tell you meat is bad. All the studies point to it. I mean, it's universal. But if you dig a little deeper, if you just scratch that veneer of vegetarianism a little deeper, you can find that, you know, these studies, you can have back any relationship you want to support. And science is just man's law. And man isn't infallible, and certainly man is never impartial. So there's always an agenda behind this. And I was really surprised when I started studying this. So I'm looking at these studies which look universally sound, principled, scientific. Meat is bad. You know, thousands are dying. But you have to look at why we're cutting out these food groups. So there's a study out in 2017 that actually countered a lot of this that we're hearing right now. So it was a British Journal of Sports Medicine study. And when you go back to the 80s, they were saying, you know, the dietary cholesterol and all that, how bad it was. And we've been avoiding this, you know, forever. So most of the dairy went out the window and the meat. And but this study actually showed that the dietary fat recommendations since 1977 were always, always without sufficient evidence. And they never proved a significant relationship between total and saturated fat and mortality. So that was really surprising in light of how many studies today seem to say, yes, meat is bad. And so why is meat bad? That's a question. You know, and it's not just is it bad, but why would it be bad? Mm-hmm. And why meat all of a sudden? So we looked at that, and these studies also never took into account the type of meat that we're eating. So is it processed meat?
Right.
Is it hot dogs, which you can get every kill floor ingredient in there, or is it grass-fed? I mean, there's a vast difference in the fats that are in those type of meats and the nutrients that you're taking in. Processed meats do lead to a lot of diseases. We know that.
So but if you look, you're saying those who are kind of saying, well, we need to cut back on meat overall, or so they're advocating a prohibition in meat generally, they're not taking into account quality. You have people that are basically saying broad brush, everything needs to go, but they're not taking into account the fact that there would be elements within certain processes or the way that the meat is coming to us, the way that it's raised, whatever the case might be, versus those that would be a healthier versions of meat.
Exactly. When you look at a healthy meat, say grass-fed or organic, it just has very healthy fats and usable nutrients, much more so than, say, those confined to industrial feedlots. Mm-hmm. And these healthy meats actually decrease the heart disease risk, and they increase the HDL, the good cholesterol. And same with dairy, milk, cheese, and butter. They have this vast array of healthy fats that we need and the nutrients that we need. And so when you separate these two, you have no studies that actually take these healthy meats by and of themselves, or they take the bad meats and say, you know, what is the difference between the two? Mm-hmm. They're always lumped into one pile, and therefore meat is bad for you.
Okay, so if I guess in some ways most of the meat that is available that most people would be able to pick up, that is, say, within the budget for the average person, there's a lot of it that would be probably more in the bad side of things. If you're going out there and say, I'm only going to eat the really choice grass-fed beef or wild-caught fish or that type of thing, you're generally going to pay quite a bit more. So if you, what's the payoff between how much of the meat that you might have that might not be as high of a quality as would be optimal versus a completely plant-based diet? And how might that affect our health nutrition-wise if maybe we have some of the less healthy meat as part of our diet?
Sure. If you start somebody with a vegetarian diet, of course you're going to see improvements. I mean, you're going from bad health to a vegetarian diet, and you're going to see a vast improvement in your health. That's not to say that you can't stay on a vegetarian diet for a long time and do good at it, but it's not optimal. And it's certainly going to beat the average North American diet. I mean, that's just because you're eating a lot of plant-based food, a lot of nuts, a lot of seeds and such. On the other end of the spectrum, if you're buying meats, like myself, I'm caught in the same kind of conundrum. I have a family, and sometimes the meat just is so exorbitant, the prices, that I can't afford that cut that day. Mm-hmm. What we usually do is we go around and we visit farms. Or we'll go look for those prices that we need to have, say, on chicken. There's always a sale somewhere. And a lot of it hinges down to effort. I mean, we do a lot of driving once a week to get our groceries. So we'll look for those specials. We'll look to see. I mean, my big thing right now is we're doing a lot of ground beef. So I'll say, well, we'll eat the organic ground beef. It's lower in price than, say, a higher cut of steak. Mm-hmm. Well, of course it is. So I can get a lot more for my family. So I do have to compromise. No doubt about it. I'm just not in a position to say I can get grass-fed all the time as much as I want. There's just no way. We don't live in that kind of world. So let's say you're making some compromise between the two. You can do that very well. Don't go into hot dogs. You know, most hot dogs are really bad for you. We know that. Luncheon meats are just saturated with chemicals. So we have to make some good choices still, you know, try to get the best choices that you can and look around for those stores that a lot of stores do sell organic versus the normal commercial type. And a lot of times those do go on sale. Mm-hmm. So we do have the choice for many people that they can say, you know, I can afford this week and do the best that I can while still eating a lot of vegetables and the other healthy foods.
Okay.
To maintain good health.
So you said that the person who goes from, say, eating a lot of bad meat, if they get off of that and they go vegetarian, that they're going to see some improvement into their health. What are the problems with, say, a purely vegetarian diet if you cut out animal protein altogether?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now, vegetarians, because you're restricting a food group, so you're going to lack B12 right away, and you're going to lack those omega-3 fatty acids that are crucial to our health, and as well as vitamin D3. Those are the three big ones that have to be received from supplements, fortified foods, and such to maintain good health. And the other thing is many vegetarians also, they turn to a slew of imitation dairy or meat products, because you're taking out meat, mm-hmm. so you have to put something else in, or you're going to have to just eat carbohydrates and vegetables. So then they eat imitation meats and such. But the problem with those, they're still man-made.
Yeah. So you're actually substituting one badly or overproduced or manufactured item for another one that's maybe even more highly engineered.
Well, I mean, it sounds really grand. I'm eating vegetarian and I'm eating all these, vegetarian tofurkies and tofu burgers. But they have just as many unhealthy and unpronounceable ingredients. I mean, I actually went and checked all this and I was astounded at how much of these bad ingredients there are in those. Mm-hmm. And a third prong in that really lifestyle is life gets busy. We know that. And I have a lot of vegetarian or vegan clients, and you would be surprised how many simple carbs, sugars, and bad fats appear in a vegetarian diet. Mm-hmm. I mean, optimally, you would say, no, that's not going to happen. But again, life gets busy, and I see a lot of vegetarians that are overweight. Mm-hmm. So on paper, yes, it looks really good, but you know, in practice, you're gonna have a lifestyle that could be rich in problems as well. You could have blood sugar problems, hormone level problems, depression. A lot of vegetarians have depression, anxiety, and weight gain. That's shown in studies now.
So it sounds like I'm kind of getting the message from what you're saying here. We're looking for a third way, basically, that it's not so much meat versus plant. It's whole food, it's simple food, or it's food that's well produced that we're going to be going for. And obviously, we want a lot of plant based nutrition in our diet, but we do want to make sure that we're getting some of the benefits from those animal proteins as well.
Right. The thing about it is, why do we have to go to an extreme all the time? So there's so many extremes in eating today, especially with, you can go vegetarian, you can go high protein and such. If you eat a moderate amount of meats and try to do as good as you can with the quality, you may not always succeed.
And what's a moderate amount of meats?
You know, if I eat meat two or three times a week, I don't have to eat a lot of it, mm-hmm. but I do enjoy it and I make it the best quality that I can. Mm-hmm. My vegetables still should dominate. So I have a good serving of vegetables on my plates, and my carbohydrates are always whole. So I make sure that I have a good quality there, you know, and just make sure that you eat a balanced meal and a whole meal and a meal that looks unprocessed. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. So when we're looking at studies and we say, is a vegetarian diet better than a whole food diet that's minimally processed, that's nonsense and that's a myth.
So just to finish up, what are some good sources of protein that would not be animal-based, that if someone were trying to cut down on meat, and there may be some because of one health issue or another, that they wouldn't even be able to have meat, but how could we, you mentioned those three nutrients that they need, B12, omega-3 fats, and the D3, I think it was. How do we make sure that we have a good amount of the maybe animal-based protein?
Well, if you're following a vegetarian diet,
Or even if you're trying to minimize the amount of meat that you that you're eating for one reason or another.
Right. Okay. Well, you can get nuts and seeds have a good amount of protein. Some grains have proteins like quinoa, buckwheat has a fair amount. Soy also does. I'm not a fan of soy at all because most of it is genetically modified. And beans, of course, and hummus, you know, making your own hummus from beans. So the good thing about it is today, if you're looking on the internet, you can get lists upon lists and do this very safely. If you're going to follow a more vegetarian diet for health reasons and say some people actually cannot stomach meat, they can't digest it very well. So just out of necessity, they're going to have to go towards a more vegetarian lifestyle, which is fine. You can do very well on it. You just have to be very careful. And then, so if you need that list, basically you just need to put in Google and look, I need a list of vegetarian protein sources, and you just get a complete list that you can abide by and just have good health for down the road.
Interesting stuff. We've been talking with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about vegetarianism, the good and the bad and some of the ugly. He's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Jörg, we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Darkness is descending on the long, historically extraordinary Anglo-American age. Britain, once a globe-girdling empire, is now a third-rate power, marginalized next to a growing European superstate. America, once the greatest superpower on earth, has lost a significant amount of global influence and has many other nations working to undermine it. History teaches that world orders don't last. They come and go. This present one is giving way to something very different, and it truly will be the world's loss. However, Britain and America's brightest days are not history. Glowing within their remarkable past is the promise of a far more luminous future. The British and the Americans have long believed they were duty-bound, even destined, to lead the world. Kirk Emmert wrote in Winston S. Churchill on Empire, "The glory of the British Empire was its service to a cause that transcended Britain, that transcended history, that transcended time itself." That cause, he wrote, was to lift human life away from barbarism and savagery towards civilization and human excellence. Churchill passionately devoted himself to promoting that empire and considered the fostering of civilization as its highest purpose. He wrote, "Empire civilizes both the ruled and their rulers." The United States founders sought to establish a lasting beacon of liberty and democracy to the nations. Lyman Beecher said that the nation was destined to lead the way in the moral and political emancipation of the world. Abraham Lincoln said America must ensure that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. Since it entered into World War II, the United States has essentially served as the guarantor of peace in the world. All such human efforts are imperfect, but until recently, the fruits of the Anglo-American effort to benefit mankind have been more sweet than bitter. Biblical prophecy reveals there's an awesome reason for this, and it points back to ancient history, and it also illuminates an inspiring future. You can read it in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. The reason is that these nations are the modern descendants of ancient Israel. The Bible shows that Israel was given a great responsibility. God chose this nation to represent him and to set an example for the world. Biblical history and prophecy show that God still intends for Israel's descendants to fulfill this glorious purpose. There's an outstanding example in Jeremiah, which was written for the end time. Chapter 13, verse 11, God describes wearing the nation of Israel like a man wearing a waistcloth or a belt as a handsome ornament. Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote that this is the big overview. God created the tribes, later nations of Israel, for an incredible purpose. They were created to be a praise and a glory to God. The nations of Israel were to cause the whole world to praise and glorify God. This waistband depicted in Jeremiah 13, it was made out of linen, just like the garments of Israel's priests, which were made for glory and for beauty, it says in Exodus. The nation had a priestly calling, which means a responsibility to serve other nations and point them to God. Israel was like a priestly garment worn by God himself. But if you look at that passage in Jeremiah, you see what God was illustrating. God told Jeremiah not to wash the waist belt, even to stick it into a rock beside the river for a time until it was ruined and unusable. This way, God was vividly depicting how Israel failed in its beautiful calling. But if you notice, verses 9 and 10 of that chapter also apply to Israel's modern descendants, nations that God condemns for arrogance, evil, disobedience, self-will, idolatry. They became worthless to God. And God says he's going to dispose of these rebellious nations like a rotten girdle. When John Winthrop spoke of America as a city on a hill in 1630, he issued a warning based on prophecies like this one in Jeremiah. He wrote, "We must consider that we will be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." This is where Britain and America find themselves today. And it's going to get worse. The sun is setting on Anglo-American dominance. And when these nations fall, the world will plunge back into the blackness of barbarism and savagery. However, the Bible that prophesied this fall also prophesies that Britain and America's brightest days are yet to come. Jeremiah 33 depicts a time yet future after America and Britain have endured tribulation intended to correct them for their sins. It contains God's promises to restore prosperity to them and make them a positive example. They will become a praise and an honor before all the nations of the earth, Jeremiah 33 says. God intends to help these nations become the positive example they have always struggled and failed to be. But it won't be Pax Americana or the British Empire they will be promoting, but the peace of God and the kingdom of God. The King of Kings will lift all human life towards civilization and excellence. And Britain and America finally will submit to him and become the beautiful, godly ornaments they were always intended to be. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Abraham Blondeau and Jorg Mardian. Also thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Herbert W. Armstrong. Happiness is something that one can never reach out and take. It is something that you can have only by giving. And the more you give, the more you have. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.